Our ancient word for today is from the 38th chapter of the book of Job, the first 11 verses. Then the Holy One answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut up the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped. God of the sparrow, God of the whale, God of the swirling stars. Let's sing together.
God of the sparrow, God of the
pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Okay, the beginning of my, Gary, a few weeks ago your notes were missing. The beginning of my text is missing this morning. I don't know what happened to it. I'll wing it. And this text from Job is a challenging one, but it's there, and it's part of our tradition, and so I want to talk about it this morning. You may not love what I have to say or agree, but hang with me, and maybe we'll have some discussion about it afterwards. In my reflection on what it means to be spiritual and what it means to bring our spirituality to worship, I think about what it would mean to actually have God present in our lives, to have God present with us. I don't know how deeply we think about that. I mean, I don't think about it deeply all the time, but certainly there are occasions when one wonders, if we serve a living God, what does it mean for God to be present? What would that be like? Now, I have to say that I'm missing this wonderful quote from Annie Dillard that I wanted to start with, but maybe you remember this, the one where she talks about how church people, when we come together to worship, are very often, most often, very nice and polite and have a lovely worship service. But if God were to be really present, she says, the rafters might shake and the earth tremble under our feet, and rather than wearing our Easter bonnets, our hats to church, we ought to wear our crash helmets and be prepared for what it might be to be in the presence of the living God who draws us out to where we can never return. Indeed, what would it be like to find ourselves drawn out beyond our carefully crafted limits to look at those other limits set by the great God of the universe? Remember the television series Joan of Arcadia? Anybody remember that besides me? I loved that show. It was only on for about a season or so, I think, maybe two, I forget. It featured a typical bright, pretty teenage girl who finds herself visited by God on a regular basis. The girl, Joan, lives with her parents and her two brothers in the mythical suburban community of Arcadia, somewhere here in Southern California, I believe. God comes to her unbidden, often in the most unlikely guises. The cop on the corner, a cute, inked, and pierced goth boy on the bus, a homeless man, a small girl on the playground, a garbage collector, a cafeteria worker. The forms are many and varied and always, always unexpected. Every week, God has a task for Joan to accomplish before the end of the episode. Joan usually, as we might, resists God's assignment initially, then learns her lesson before the hour is over. In the beginning, Joan is skeptical that these characters really are God. You can imagine, how would you think if God came to you as the garbage collector or the cafeteria worker? She has some religious background as a nominal Catholic, but she has certainly not been on any quest to bring the living God close, certainly not this close. Personally, she's much more concerned, as any teenage girl might be, with fitting in as a slightly geeky teenager. But slowly, as the encounters continue from week to week, she learns to accept the inevitability of her fate as a chosen one. And she begins to wonder about the nature of things in new and exciting and confusing ways. Questions of compassion and fairness, of justice and mercy, of free will and God's will begin to ferment in her brain and in her life. Toward the end of the series, there's an episode in which which acts as a powerful illustration, I think, of what today's text offers us. In her growing insight into God and God's way for her and for the world around her, she becomes curious about, and I think concerned for, what God knows and what God carries. Interesting. She has this kind of concern for what are the burdens that God carries. God spends most of the episode trying to, she asks to see what God sees and knows. God spends the rest of the episode trying to dissuade her, knowing that it's more than she can ever handle. But finally, she pesters God, in this case, it's a young priest, to the point he gives in. He offers to give her the tiniest glimpse of life as God sees it. In this moment of revelation, the screen goes psychedelic with brightly colored lights, and the music swells in a kind of cacophony. When the picture returns to normalcy, we see Joan laid out on the floor of the church in which the theophany has occurred. You see, even a glimpse of God is overwhelming. In the end, Joan, without her crash helmet, finds herself looking past limits, limits beyond which it is not safe for her to go. In today's text, Job finds himself looking at limits in a similar fashion. We don't have time to unpack the complexity of the book of Job. Scholars have written volumes on it over the years. Synopsis will have to serve. Job was a wealthy man with a family and land and all the resources of an ancient potentate, everything he could want. All was right with his world. The ancient myth on which the biblical book is based says that God and the Satan, not the devil, as Milton created the devil, but one of those heavenly beings who at that time in tradition attended God in a heavenly council. The God and the Satan strike what seems like a rather unholy bargain to test poor Job. You see, God takes pride in Job's faithfulness. So the Satan counters that if God took away all that which Job has been blessed, he would not remain so faithful. And the bet is on. For the balance of the book, we find Job poor, alone, afflicted, sitting on the dung heap, trying to figure out what's happened to him and why. A string of friends, come with explanations, most of which are based on the belief that Job has to have done something wrong to deserve such punishment. But to Job's credit, he will have none of this. He's insistent to the end that he has done nothing to deserve his fate. Frustrated with his friends, he increasingly cries out to God to come forward with an explanation. For most of the book, Job suffers through the silence of God, while his friends provide plenty of distracting noise in the background. In fact, there are 2 chapters of prose and 35 chapters of poetry before God is even stirred to respond here in the 38th chapter, which I read from. This morning's text is the beginning of God's answer to Job. Here we find several chapters of powerful poetry in which God puts Job in his place. Ironically, in the process, helping Job to see and understand. To begin with, God comes on with overbearing power. in vivid contrast to the God who speaks to Elijah, for instance, in a still, small voice. God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind, from the center of the chaos, from the heart of that untamed matter from which creation was drawn, from the unknown territory where God dwells. Job gets psychedelic shapes and colors. Job gets thunder and lightning and swirling wind. Though he has begun to despair that God will ever come, Job does not seem particularly surprised by the manner in which God eventually does come. He understands that if God comes, it will be in an impressive manner. A crash helmet could be useful. The poetry the writer puts on the lips of God is some of the most powerful and beautiful poetry ever written. Part of me would have been happy just to read the whole 38th chapter this morning, if indeed not all of chapters 38 through 42. When you get a chance in your home, go home and read those chapters again. The poetry of God. The poetry carries us to different dimensions of reality, as good poetry often does, right? Carries us to different dimensions of reality. And without question, causes us, like Job, to look at limits. Suddenly, the horizon darkens and the fierce storm arises, and Job finds himself face to face with God, or at least close enough that the voice of God thunders in his ears. Then the Holy One answered Job out of the whirlwind, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." It's a pretty intimidating way to begin a conversation, yeah? Actually, it isn't much of a conversation. God has 123 verses to Job's 9. Yeah, in football terms, we'd say that was a rout. "Who is this that? Where were you when?" These questions are overwhelming and unanswerable for us as human creatures. They put us in our place. Some would argue that God is a bully here, and the response is overkill. After all, doesn't the myth say that God set up Job's suffering in the first place? Now, in response to Job's questioning, Job's lament and cry for justice, God's response may seem like a smokescreen to avoid taking responsibility for God's abuse of Job. You may argue that there's a lot of bluster in God's response. You may say that God never answers, really, Job's questions. You might contend that God is not very nice to this poor, suffering man. Already victim of every curse and misfortune possible, God seems to add insult to injury through intimidation. I'm guessing if this God was human, we would not like him very much. Maybe we don't like him anyway, certainly in this manifestation. Where is love and compassion? Where is justice and mercy? Surely this is not the whole story. Catherine Schifferdecker writes, "For all God's silence," and this is where I think my thinking about this text turns, "for all God's silence concerning human beings, God gives humanity in Job a singular place in creation." You see, Job is the only passenger on this grand tour of the cosmos. And through it, God invites him and us to see the world for a moment from a God's eye point of view and to delight in its beauty and its freedom as God does. Is this an adequate response, she asked, to Job's suffering? It is certainly not, in any conventional sense, very comforting, is it? God would probably fail a present-day pastoral care class. I don't think I would give this God a good grade in my classes, but nonetheless, these speeches of God at the end of the book of Job accomplish something profound. They move Job out of his endless cycle of grief into life again. They enable him to live freely in a world full of heartbreaking suffering and heart-stopping beauty, and to do so in a way that actually reflects God's own care for the world. It's a rugged reality, a harsh truth, a difficult scene, especially for those of us who want to emphasize the love, the compassion, the motherly grace, and the fatherly concern of the God we serve. It reminds me of C.S. Lewis in his Chronicles of Narnia, when he draws a vision of the Holy One as Aslan, the lion, that bridges both the grand and the tender power held in eternal tension. As loving and compassionate as Aslan can be, we are reminded over and over in the books that Aslan is no tame lion. Nor can we be so arrogant as to think we might tame the great God of the universe. God cares, but in God's own time and in God's own way, which we do not always understand. In the end, Job does see in new ways. The brief response that Job makes at the end of God's discourse acknowledges his having looked at his limits and of having arrived at some new understanding of what they mean for him. He says in some of his 9 verses, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now I see, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Well, my guess is that we are not entirely satisfied with this word of Job's. We don't like for anyone to use language like, "I despise myself." And frankly, we're pretty sure that with enough time and capital, we could solve all the mysteries of the universe, right? We live that way sometimes in this world. We don't really look at limits. We don't want to accept that we are creatures. We don't want to give ourselves in service to a God who is the eternal more, one who will always be out there beyond our grasp and our boxing in. Sometimes it seems the only way for us to open, to grasp the reality of the holy is to be flattened on the floor like Job, or laid out against our limits like Job. It's painful to encounter the living God and to discover how tiny one is in God's presence. So how then are we to live in the face of such overwhelming power? The tradition teaches us that none may see the face of God and live. That great lawgiver, Moses, was only allowed to catch the trailing trace of the hem of God's garment as the Holy One passed by. So I think what is remarkable in this tale of Job is this encounter itself. Surely the Holy One who holds such power is in no way accountable to any aspect of what that one has created, human or otherwise. And yet, out of the whirlwind, the voice of thunder is directly leveled at Job. No one can argue that what God has to say is either apologetic or comforting. In truth, there is no direct address of Job's complaint at all. Instead, God makes sure that Job knows who is in charge, who is boss, and still, I think there's something strangely wonderful in God's willingness to see this creature, to encounter him directly, and to take him on an illuminating tour of creation. Whatever Job has been through and will yet go through, he matters to the Holy One. You matter to the Holy One. I matter to the Holy One. Job has significance for his Creator, who simply will not let him go. This is the awesome God we serve. The Holy One who refuses to let us go, no matter how we are prone to wander, to question and challenge, to focus on our own concerns and want things to work out our way, to exercise control over life and its giver. There's always more for us to encounter and take in. There's always more for us to learn and to grow into. Maybe in the end, the most we can claim is Job's great affirmation of faith. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end, the Holy One will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh, I will see God. How my heart yearns within me. Amen.